Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Dreamed I was an Eskimo. Frozen wind began to blow. Under my boots and around my toes. Frost that bit the ground below. Was 100 degrees below zero. And my mama cried. And my mama cried. Save your money, don't go to the show. Well, I turned around and I said, ho, ho. Well, I turned around and I said, ho, ho. Well, I turned around and I said, ho, ho. And the northern lights commenced to glow. And she said, a tear in her eye.
Watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow. Watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow.
Well, right about that time, people, a fur trapper who was strictly from commercial had the unmitigated audacity to jump up from behind my igloo.
Peek-a-boo. Ooh.
And he started in the whipping on my favorite baby seal with a lead-filled snowshoe. I said, with a lead.
Lead-filled
snowshoe.
Snowshoe.
He said, peek-a-boo.
Peek-a-boo.
With a lead-filled, with a lead-filled snowshoe.
Snowshoe.
He said peek-a-boo. He went right upside the head of my favorite baby seal. He went whap with a lead-filled snowshoe, and he hit him on the nose, and he hit him on the fin, and he. That got me just about as evil as an Eskimo boy can be. So I bent down and I reached down and I scooped down and I gathered up a generous mitten full of the deadly
yellow snow.
The deadly yellow snow from right there where the huskies go. Whereupon I proceeded to take that mitten full of the deadly yellow snow crystals and rub it all into his beady little eyes with a vigorous circular motion hitherto unknown to the people in this area, but destined to take the place of the mud shark in your mythology. Here it goes now, the circular motion, rub it! And then in a fit of anger, I pounced again. Great googly moogly. I jumped up and down the chest of a. I injured the fur trapper. Well, he was very upset, as you can understand. And rightly so, because the deadly yellow snow crystals had deprived him of his sight. And he stood up and he looked around and he said, I can't see. I can't see. Oh, woe is me. snow cone and stuffed it in my right eye. He took a dog do snow cone and stuffed it in my other eye. And the husky wee wee, I mean the doggy wee wee, has blinded me. And I can't see temporarily. Well, the fur trapper stood there with his arms outstretched across the frozen white wasteland, trying to figure out what he's going to do about his deflicted eyes. And it was at that precise moment that he remembered an ancient Eskimo legend wherein it is written on whatever it is that they write it on up there, that if anything bad ever happens to your eyes as a result of some sort of conflict with anyone named Nanook, the only way you can get it fixed up is to go trudging across the tundra, mile after mile. Trudging across the tundra, right down to the parish of St. Alfonso. Yes, indeed, here we are. At St. Alfonso's Pancake Breakfast, where I stole the margarine and wheedled on the bingo cards in lieu of the latrine. I saw a handsome parish lady make her entrance like a queen. Why, she was totally chenille and her old man was a marine. As she abused the sausage patty and said, why don't you treat me mean? At St. Alfonso's Pancake Breakfast,
get off the bus,
where I stole the margarine.
So light and fluffy brown, they're the finest in the town. They're so light and fluffy brown, they're the finest in the town.
Good morning, Your Highness.
Okay, that is Frank Zappa. And Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, Nanook Rubs It In, and St. Alfonso's Pancake Breakfast. I can't speak.
What do you do with that? Well, of course, you listen to it and enjoy it.
I love it.
The thing that gets me, I mean, when that's from the album Apostrophe, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is, I think it's his most successful record. And it was 1970-something?
74.
74. And by then he'd done eight. This is his 18th album. It's incredible. He was so incredibly prolific. But the thing that gets me about that is that even though it's sort of, it's comedic in the lyric and everything, it is funny, you know, it's genuinely funny, but the playing is ferocious. It's not just badass. It is ridiculously complicated. Those drum patterns, that bit of 7/8 at the beginning, it's just beautiful. The whole construction of it, the mix, I think, is just remarkable, considering what they were using at that time. No Pro Tools, it was all on tape, you know, and the backing vocals, it's just absolutely beautifully recorded, beautifully delivered, beautifully written. It's magnificent.
It's sublime, and that's all the fault of our son Joe. He messaged us and says, I request. Now, we don't usually do requests, but Joe, I tell you, man, you can have 50 points to Gryffindor for that, because that was an absolute classic song selection. Remarkable. I'm blown away.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. And the musicians that he's had in that band, the Mothers of Invention, that was his band. And he, of course, he was principally a solo artist, but, you know, Terry Bozzio on drums, he had Ainsley Dunbar, he had George Duke. You know, it's amazing the amount of people that went through it. But apparently, he was really fierce with his musicians, and he used to be absolutely, totally on it in terms of rehearsal, and they had to absolutely get it right. And he didn't drink, and he didn't take drugs.
That's the thing that I admire so much about him. Is the fact he didn't have that kind of drug stimulation, that his mind was on fire and creating all this naturally stuff. So the other thing is, well, with Frank Zappa, now I've heard of Frank Zappa, and I know I've heard of Dweezil Zappa as well.
That's his son, yeah.
Yeah, his son. And I've always been looking for a song or a couple of songs as an entry point into his work, because I've never really... If you said to me before we played this, OK, sing me a Frank Zappa song, I couldn't. Isn't that weird?
Mm.
But for me, I feel like I've got a pickaxe and got through the ice and I've got myself a little hole with the Eskimos, right? And I'm a big fan of Pingu, so I love that kind of igaloo. I love when he goes... Great googly moogly. That's just great. I mean, the whole storyline and everything. And so for me, pictorially as well, because I think in pictures, is absolutely perfect. I'm so excited by him. So this is the other thing as well. So Frank, I wanted to know a little bit about where he came from as well. So his mum was called Rosemary, and she was Italian and French ancestry. His dad was Francis, who was also Sicilian and Greek and Arab ancestry. So they had this whole concoction of cultural influences in their family. But his dad was a chemist and a mathematician, and he worked in the defense industry, and he was actually working at a chemical warfare facility in Maryland making mustard gas.
No.
Yeah. So they moved around a lot, and they used to have gas masks at home in case of an accident at the plant, and he was often sick as a child. So there was one instance they were saying that he had really bad sinusitis, and they stuck radium pellets up his nose.
No.
Yeah.
Flipping egg.
So you can see, and then what happened is then he was, in his teens, he really liked 20th century classical composers like Stravinsky, and he was into 50s rhythm and blues and doo-wop music, and he started writing classical in high school, and he was playing drums because he loved rhythm and he loved blues bands, and later he switched to electric guitar. And so you can kind of see where these influences have come from, and some of his imagery, the themes that are recurring throughout his work, from what I gather.
Yeah.
That I'm really looking, but I just wanted to get a sense of the boy. And I really, really, really like Frank Zappa.
And of course, that was plenty of fuzz guitar on it for all our
really,
fuzz guitar fans.
The mighty fuzz.
No matter what you are, I will always be with you.
Badfinger, No Matter What, from the album No Dice on Apple Records, November 1970.
Now, I know nothing about Badfinger.
Well, I've got white finger occasionally when I get cold.
Sounds really funny. It's a bad finger.
Yeah, well, a bad white finger. But anyway.
We've got gold finger.
We have.
White finger. Yeah. So, no, all I know is that... Oh, anyway, you tell me, because you know about these guys.
Well, yeah. I mean, they were signed to Apple, yeah, and the Beatles label.
Yeah.
Not the software and hardware manufacturer.
Oh, yeah, of course. Isn't that funny now that you have to say that?
Dead right, yeah.
Ooh.
But they were signed to Apple, and this track and the whole album was produced by Jeff Emerick, who was the Beatles engineer. Yeah. Now, I know engineers worked on this, but I've read the book. You're halfway through it.
I am indeed. I love it.
I've read the whole thing. Fantastic read. Great read. But if you listen to that song, the production is dynamite. Absolutely dynamite. And does it sound like? It sounds like the Beatles. The Leslie, the guitar through the Leslie. The mix is sensational. It was recorded partly at Abbey Road's... at Apple Studios and also at Trident Studios. Mm. And, I mean, you need to read the book because the whole tale is quite amazing about the studios. But, you know, I just love... And the song. Oh, my God, the song. It's just one great song. And they wrote... did they write Without You as well?
Funniest thing, that's the one bit of research that I actually knew about, because I know that song. It was, yeah, what was it now? It was Without You, and it was written by Tom Evans and Pete Ham, and Mariah Carey had a hit with it in 1994, and Harry Nilsson, that's the one I really love, in 1972. But there's been 180 covers of that song. That's what got me. 180 covers of it.
And the sad thing about this,
it's beautiful.
Song, but the sad thing about this is that Ham committed suicide because he hadn't got any money. The music business completely screwed him, and it was years and years before they got money. Yeah, and even then, Evans also committed suicide because he had an argument with one of the members of the band. But they both the songwriters of those songs committed suicide. Terrible. And the tale is agony. I weep when I read the tale of Badfinger because they were so talented. The songs did so well, and they should have been in the Bahamas with swimming pools, you know? And because they wrote these songs. It's awful. It's an awful story of music business. And at the moment, I'm just reading this book by Phil Brown, another one, because we're on this engineering thing at the moment.
Yeah.
And, you know... His career is also a catalogue of music business just ripping off everybody, you know, and things not being released. And it's just awful, you know?
That makes me feel bad. But I know that it's bad, but that is totally abhorrent and unacceptable.
Totally.
It really is.
Yeah.
So what do? We have the music that we can celebrate. And yet, you know, always in a lifetime, you really wish that somebody would be able to reap the benefits of actually of their work, of their creativity. So the best thing we can do for the guys is to play their music and celebrate them in their magnificence, really.
Absolutely, because I think it's one great song. It's one of the greatest songs, you know, out there. Beautiful, beautifully produced, beautifully written, beautifully performed, beautifully engineered.
Higher.
You're listening to the Supertones Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was a track by a band called War and Low Rider. What a great name, Low Rider.
Great track.
That guy is the sax player in the band called Charles Miller. He did the vocals on that.
Is that
Low
right?
Low Rider.
Now, wouldn't you want to sound like him? Doesn't he sound cool?
He did. He does, actually.
Ridiculously cool.
That, what? I was going to say, we're both about to say the same thing, probably.
What a groove. Yeah. Unbelievable. Every time it comes on, you know, the radio, you know, you listen to it. And just to explain a little bit about the show, I mean, these tracks that we play on the show are stuff we listen to at home all the time on our vinyl, you know, the weekend, in the evenings or whatever, when we're cooking and having lunch and dinner.
And stuff that you know that I necessarily don't know as well, and then vice versa. We kind of have, because there's some bands I don't know, like I didn't know Badfinger and I don't really know War either.
But you love the track.
I love it.
Well, it's one of those tracks that everybody knows, isn't it? You know, it's like you hear it and it just, you know.
But there's energy. There's like a beauty and an energy with it that it's just like this fusion of influences, and it just lifts you off the ground and you just feel bloody fantastic, actually.
Well, you do. And it was conceived, this band, by a record producer, wasn't it?
Yeah, a guy called Jerry.
Jerry
Goldstein.
Oh, Gary Goldstein. Right,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And he was, he'd worked on like My Boyfriend's Back and he'd Hang On Sloopy and I Want Candy. And he teamed up with Eric Burdon, the ex-lead singer from The Animals.
Mm.
And so originally the band was called Eric Burdon and War. And what happened was that Goldstein saw the musicians playing at the Ragdoll in North Hollywood, and he just loved their sound, and that's how they came to form this band together, because they were just fusing elements of rock and funk and jazz and Latin and rhythm and blues and reggae and everything.
Well, that cowbell always makes you laugh, of course. It's the more cowbell sketch, you know. And at the beginning, when it comes in, you imagine, you know, the sketch. Any muso will know this sketch. It's a very funny. But the whole Latin percussion thing, that's what really makes it. But it's funky as well, you know. I think they really did a great shit that we're thinking about the sketch. But it really does, you know, really motor along, doesn't it?
And it does, and they toured extensively around Europe and the UK. They played Hyde Park, and the NME said that they were the best live band that they, you know, this chap had ever seen.
No.
Yeah, and they played Ronnie Scott's as well in 1970. And sadly, that was the last gig that Jimi Hendrix played, because he joined the band for the last half an hour of their set.
Is that right?
And the next day he died. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So it must have been a real Yeah. So with War, though, Eric Burdon left the band later on. So really, this was their peak time, I think, these songs around this era.
But he wasn't in the band at this time?
Yeah, he was. It was just later on he left.
All right, okay.
Or somewhere during the tour.
Right, cool.
They just changed the name.
Yeah.
From Eric Burdon to just War.
Yeah. Lovely band, though.
I know, but that's a thing, and you can see, you know, and I don't want that negative thing either, you know. Okay, the thing is, I think we celebrate life on this show.
We
celebrate the fact that was and is an absolutely brilliant track.
Direct you into my arms. into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms. I don't believe in the existence of angels. But looking at you, I wonder if that's true. But if I did, I would summon them together. Ask them to watch over you, while to each burn a candle for you, to make bright and clear your path, and to walk like Christ in grace and love, and guide you into my arms, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms. Into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms. But I believe in love, and I know that you do. I believe in some kind of path that we can walk down, me and you. So keep your candles burning, make a journey bright and pure, that you'll keep returning always and evermore. Into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Into My Arms, from the Boatman's Call, 1997, his 10th studio album.
Well, I didn't know that Nick Cave was Australian.
No.
Yeah, I hadn't even...
Well, he was together with Kylie for a bit, wasn't he? I mean, not that that makes a difference, because she's Australian, but I mean, people get together all the time.
No, it was just odd. It was just something that I hadn't actually worked at. And then, I mean, because we bought the documentary, didn't we, of the... It's a semi-fictional Day in the Life, 20,000 Days on Earth.
Mm.
So I kind of... I haven't actually finished... watching it all yet, because I don't know, I just watched it, didn't really connect with me the first time we watched it.
It's definitely
it's a bit
out
difficult
there.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I can do out there, absolutely, that's somewhere I feel very comfortable with. Mm. But I don't know, maybe I needed to have more chocolate that day or something. I know, because it can be, that's the thing, you know. And I always think, just leave things for a while and go back and see if it connects in, and I never make things fit unless they want to fit, you know, in terms of the experience.
But, well, Nick Cave, what a guy. And I've just got to say a little bit about lyric here, because that is one song, and I'm going to be soppy here, but I'm allowed to be soppy because it's our show. I wish I'd have written that for you. Now, that is something, because the lyric is magnificent. Magnificent. You know, I don't believe in an interventionist God. That's the first line. What a confidence of a songwriter to start a song like that.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing, the feeling. And the thing is, his lyric as well, sometimes it doesn't follow the melody. What he does, he makes sure he squeezes the lyric into the melody. And sometimes it just doesn't fit, but he still does it. Nicky Wire does that with the Manic Street Preachers. And he, you know, motorcycle emptiness, he does that sort of thing. But this is a magnificent example.
I actually don't want to say too much more. I just think he's quite beautiful. And that song, as you say, is beautiful. And I was thinking, what is it? Because it feels hymnal, and yet I don't feel that it's over-religious, even though it says the word Lord. It just, it doesn't, it's not that. It's so not that.
Mm.
It's a love song.
Well, you know, that also is recorded at Psalm West, which was owned by Ireland at the time. Chris Blackwell started it off. And again, going back to this Phil Brown book that I'm reading, he worked there with Chris Blackwell quite a lot. And of course, ZTT, which is Trevor Horn's company, they produced a lot of stuff out of that studio as well, you know?
Do you notice as well, when I was closing my eyes, just listening to him sing, and he just feels so present, so close to you. You can hear the sibilance on the S's, and you just... It felt so natural and so real.
Mm.
He's there in the room. If you close your eyes, he's there with you.
Oh, he is.
Right next to you, actually.
Marvellous production, marvellous engineering. And the other thing about that, I mean, he came out of the band The Birthday Party, which were a roaring punk band. I mean, our friend Ann Alonso loves The Birthday Party, his favourite band. And they were roaring, weren't they?
Yeah, they were big in the Melbourne scene.
Yeah. Well, they were big everywhere. I think they were on at the Hacienda. I didn't see them at Hacienda, but I'm
really?
Pretty sure. Yeah, there's a YouTube video of them on at Hacienda. And, you know, it, absolutely remarkable band, though. But it was, like, really, really aggressive. And then he went on to Grinderman. We've got both of those albums as well. We're big Nick Cave fans here, you know.
Yeah.
But I think The Boatman's Call to me, that was the first album I got of his, and it just got me. It got me by the Ghoulies, and just, you know, I thought, wow. What an artist.
Your googly mooglies.
Don't listen to spies, baby, diamond ring. If that diamond ring don't shine, he gonna take it to a private eye. Oh dear, they call her Nanny Gold to make a pretty baby a Sunday coat. Oh dear, they call her Bellcat to make a pretty baby a Sunday hat. Come to my house with black cat bones. I take my baby away from home. Mother, that photo, where they been? Up to your house, I'm gone again. Bo diddly, have you heard? My pretty baby said she was a bird.
Bo Diddley from the album. Bo Diddley. Sorry. Yeah, 1962. It's just really 1962. I need to say that again because I've just realised. 1962.
Yes. And produced by the Chess Brothers because he was on Chess Records, of course.
Yeah. Now, Bo Diddley, very, very, very incredible, influential man.
Mm.
Influenced many artists like Elvis, the Pelvis. The Beatles. So that's my great aunt Winnie from Wales used to call Elvis the Pelvis. She giggled.
Elvis. Great Aunt Winnie. Every time you mention Great Aunt Winnie.
From Wales.
It always makes me laugh.
I love her so much.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And I don't know what to say now. No. Yeah, so it just stopped, haven't I? So, yeah. So, basically, he abotedly influenced Elvis, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and the Clash. So he's kind of got this... He's got this thing where he played a key role in the transition from the blues to rock and roll.
Well, it's that riff, isn't it? Duck, 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 you know?
Yeah.
The thing about that track, and I've only just listened to it again through headphones, because normally, I say we have on the songs on the sound system, the tremolo, because he's got a lot of tremolo on, which basically makes the volume go up and down, basically, like on a Fender amp or whatever. But the tremolo is so deep, it's taking away some of that rhythm. You can't actually get that rhythm. And people have sort of extemporized that rhythm out to dab, dad, dad, da, da, da. Having said that, always tracks had it in at some stage, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Rolling Stones wholesale nick that rhythm, you know. I mean, and of course many other people. And he had this wonderful square guitar, and he looks awesomely cool as well. He had this hat on pulled right down and these dark glasses. He was just wickedly cool.
It was quite an interesting story with Bo, actually, because he was adopted and raised by his mother's cousin called Gussie McDaniel, and he studied trombone and violin.
Blimey.
And then he sacked them off for the guitar. Isn't it funny?
Mm.
And there's an era as well, because he was inspired by John Lee Hooker. And so what he used to do, he supplemented his income as a carpenter, a mechanic, and he was playing on street corners.
Mm.
Now, there you go. It's this playing on street corner thing.
Yeah. You know, doing your training, doing this, you know, this tough thing. Because playing on a street corner, it's like playing... your own original songs in a busy bar, you know.
Ooh, yeah, we know that one.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's a matter of just trying to get it across and capture people's attention. You know, for him, you know, for a few dollars, you know, or a few cents. But that's what it's all about. And I think now what we have in this day of fame, where everyone wants to be famous, everybody wants to be on stage, don't they? We talk about this a lot.
And there's more people on stage, and we need audience. You know, we need somebody to actually come and in the audience.
Yeah. But they don't want to do the work, you know? Because, you know, it's all about... I mean, I've seen you sweat blood playing your bass. I've seen you for hours upon hour just playing. And that is why, you know, you're playing like you do. You're a wonderful bass player. You had the talent originally, but you've got to put the work in. It's simple as that, you know. And on a street corner, there's nothing better than teaching you how to perform, you know, when you're doing that sort of thing.
It's quite... And just live gigs, you know, we all say it's like you can have 10 rehearsals, but it doesn't beat one live gig. You learn everything when you're playing live, really. You can dial stuff in so much. But you've really got to get out of there playing, haven't you?
That's right. And the beauty of it is, unless somebody's captured it on a bloody mobile phone, any cock-ups are gone forever. It's just in the mists of time, so you just smooth through and, you know, feel
I was thinking about this the other day, because, you know, there was a point where every time we were playing, it was just like the phones and people aren't really being in the moment with you. They're just, like, recording you. Mm. And, like, you've just got all these cameras in your face and... And I've just thought, well, I mean, I love the fact that people are there and I love the fact that people want to document it, but what do you do with it? This is the thing. It's not, I don't mean to be mean about people's care, but if we're all recording and not living, then what's going on?
Believe my soul, I gotta play king.
Fitz and Cara, Black Cat Bone from the debut album Beauty and the Beast in 2010.
Well, that's real rootsy, isn't it? You can smell the dust on the floorboards on that one, can't you? You can see those rusty nails.
You can. And they're an item, these guys, aren't they?
Yeah, 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 I think so.
Were they originally called Fitz
and Cara Robinson? Right, that's the name on the actual album. But they've just shortened it now, so it's just Hat, Fitz and Cara.
Right, cool.
But they're a unique combination of folk, roots and gospel blues. I love this description. With old-time flavourings reminiscent of a time once forgotten.
Lovely.
Lovely.
Well, it's lovely. And they're Australian as well.
Well, yeah. No, Hat is. Hat Fitz. He's Australian.
Right.
And he's had a record. He's played Byron Bay, East Coast Blues and Roots Festival, a record 18 times in a row.
Wow.
So that's good. That's great, actually. And people know, apparently he's amazing live.
I saw him live.
You did, didn't you?
I did indeed, at Manifest. When we were playing there, we were playing at Manifest. It was 2000, I can't remember what the exact year, but I think it was not far off this. 2000.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, 11, 2012. Yeah, so they're on at Manifest. I saw them live, they were fantastic. And what I loved about Cara is her playing the washboard. She's a fierce washboard player.
Is she?
Oh, yeah.
Good girl.
And they were really great. They had a great atmosphere. I can understand why people, rave about them live, because they were captivating. I watched the whole set. He's got that great sound, and he's got the fit. He understands what he's doing with that guitar.
Yeah.
He really does. And his voice, it's gritty. It's like he's been gargling with sand, you know.
Arr.
And she's got, it's more of a prettier voice, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
but it's beautiful, you know. Together, it's really good, you know.
Did you know that Cara toured Europe and the United States with Jamiroquai and Karine Bailey-Ray?
No.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Karine Bailey-Ray, our friend Bob Miller, of course, used to manage Karine. So,
indeed.
Yeah.
That's when I read that and I thought, oh, that's cool. And do you know what I really like is that people raved about her sensational voice, but she just doesn't want to be just a singer in that. You know, she wanted to be your own artist. So I love the fact that these guys are together and they're collaborating and nurturing each other from their different musical backgrounds.
Yeah, really, really beautifully. And it's just a great song. Perfect. We're off to Australia, of course, in November.
We are.
Yeah, we can't tell you where yet. But
no, because it's
playing.
Not announced yet. It's very exciting, though. But do you know what? And I'm really looking forward. I really want to see these guys live. I think they're great.
Well, they might be kicking around, so we might be able to...
Oh, we don't know, do we?
We don't know.
by the Rolling Stones from their album Their Satanic Majesty's Request, released in 1967.
Severely criticised for plagiarising Sgt. Pepper. But I don't think it does. I think it's balls.
Good for you.
Because, you know, listening to that, I think it's more advanced than Sgt. Pepper. Because Sgt. Pepper, I mean, remarkable album and all that, with all the reverse loops and all that sort of kind they'll be using in that track. It's obviously inspired by that. Certainly the Mellotron, which was actually, well, the strings were arranged by your big buddy, well, not buddy, but your one of your mentors.
Okay.
John Paul Jones.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Yeah, so the Mellotron was, and string arrangement done by him. But I love that. I think it's very dark. I love the groove of it, I think. And I think Eddie Kramer engineered it, even though we can't find out who on Wikipedia actually engineered, but I think it was Eddie Kramer because he played on that track as well. Of course, Eddie Kramer worked with Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, but a great sound. And also Olympic. And I think that Phil Brown, again, I'm reading this book, I think he was there during this session because he was working with the Rolling Stones around about that time.
Now, I've had this kind of just thoughts have just come together now. You know, when we talk about people. For me, before I met you, really, I was never really interested in the personalities behind the music. It was more about just what the music is. But when I realised, when you start working in recording studios and you're working with clients who are coming to record, a lot of this work is actually psychological, and that you have to actually work with people and help them become the artist they want to be and to express themselves.
Exactly.
So now, more and more, it's dawning on me. You know, when you talk about a collection of certain individuals together, the chemistry allows them, and they just write and produce fantastic stuff. Mm. I get it more now. Now I know about, oh yeah, so-and-so worked with him. Well, it kind of makes sense.
Well, the Rolling Stones, I mean, they're credited for producing this, but I know Jimmy Miller was kicking around, which we did a show about.
Yeah.
So, you know, I really, but I love that song. I've always loved it, you know.
Well, it was written by Keith and Mick, and apparently Mick reportedly wrote the lyrics in Brixton Prison when following his conviction on drug charges in June 1967.
As you do.
He got sent down. So what they were talking about with their the recording of their Satanic Majesties, it was long and sporadic because it was broken up by various court appearances and jail terms. Oh, it's not funny. I laugh there. But Bill Wyman was saying, he said it was very seldom that the entire band was present in the studio at one time. He said every day at the studio, it was a lottery as to who would turn up and what, if any, positive contribution they would make when they did. Keith would arrive with up to 10 people, Brian with another half a dozen, Mick, there were assorted girlfriends and friends. He said he hated it. And there were times when he wished he could just leave it. So, yeah, so that's it.
Well, time's up for this week's episode.
It goes so fast.
I know. I really enjoyed the show this week.
I did as well. So if you want to get in contact with us, we're on Instagram, Starlight Campbell, Twitter at Susie and Simon, that's S-U-Z-Y, and of course on Facebook.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes and iHeartRadio. So please tell your friends.
And catch you next week.